It's nice to be with you this evening. We've been looking at evidence for the reliability of these books we know of as the Gospels. Our faith rests on their claims, and it behooves us to know that that faith is well put, that it's not put into something that just some authority told us was true, but that we have reason to believe it's true, and that gives us tools to share with others when the opportunity arises. So we've looked at all the manuscript evidence to inform us that the text is reliable. We've now been looking at the text itself. Does all by itself, does it tell us? Does it give us reason to believe it's reliable? Some will say, well, it was written by biased people. It was written by those who were converted. And as we talked about last week, of course, the number one question is, why were they converted, especially when it cost them so much? But secondly, just because someone deeply believes in a thing and wants you to deeply believe in that thing, does that automatically mean their testimony is unreliable? And of course it doesn't. And what are some examples? What would be an example of someone who deeply believes in a thing and wants you to believe in it, and their testimony is actually true and they want you to believe in it? What's somebody we could trust in a situation like that? That's a horrible way of wording the question. We're sitting in court, and we know the person on the witness stand is innocent. But the jury doesn't know that. So this person gets up and in his or her own interest, seeking to persuade you that he or she is innocent, they offer testimony. What legitimate, reliable, good jury would say, well, you know, they're just trying to prove their own innocence, so I'm going to need to dismiss their testimony. Nobody would do that. Because bias of that sort does not automatically mean testimony is unreliable. So that argument doesn't go anywhere. We saw that when we look at the Gospels, these writers wrote in a very just-the-facts, ma'am style. It's not embellished. It's not adorned. It's very matter-of-fact. That speaks to a non-sensational, credible style at the very least. We saw they include a lot of inconvenient information, stuff that makes Jesus harder to accept. Why would they do that if they were inventing this story? And finally, last week, we were looking at supposed contradictions in Scripture. And that's where we'll be as we begin this evening. And the first category of those are what I'm calling variations in quotations. And I'm going to put quotations in quotations, because, as we saw last week, the gospel writers, writing from the standpoint of ancient Eastern biographers rather than modern Western biographers, were not always trying to give us exact quotations. Now, are there places in Scripture where we have exact quotation? There very well may be. But it was not demanded in the ancient world. And we can look at other Greco-Roman authors and see that they were not trying to give us exact quotation. As long as the statement was faithful to the meaning of the individual, it was acceptable. And we saw we do this in our own lives all the time. What did your mother say? Well, my child tells me not the exact words, but the gist of what mom said, and he has accurately told me what mom said. And if I can live on that, if I can build my life around things like that, certainly I can accept that in the Gospels. Were there any comments on that particular issue? Because we kind of hurriedly finished it last week. We were looking at Jesus' explanation of the parable of the sower, and we also looked at God's statement from heaven after Jesus was baptized, noting that in all both instances, none of the three Gospels that record it worded exactly the same way. Were there any comments or questions on that?
John, you had given, I think when you first introduced this part of your lesson, a number of supposed or apparent contradictions, and it was a large number. I've forgotten what that number was. Could you remind me?
Now, was that in last week's presentation, or was that in the first?
The first one. And you can give it to me later.
Okay, sounds great. Yeah. Let's do that. I mean, I can find it, but then you're all just going to be sitting here staring at me looking for it. So, okay, yes, thank you. Anything else that I can answer now?
No. So when you see a red leather Bible, and you get the variation between the accounts and the Gospels, mm-hmm. Are those all exact quotes from Jesus?
No, that's just something the publisher did. Okay. No, those things we looked at last week where Jesus is describing the good ground, you know, that's going to be in red in those red letter Bibles. It is what Jesus said. You notice even though Matthew, Mark, and Luke weren't identical, they all mentioned the good seed. They all mentioned certain things. There were certain signposts in all of those statements that were identical. So I think we are getting some of Jesus' exact words. But yeah, we're getting paraphrases. We're getting explanations. And
the exact quotes would be in Greek.
Well, that's true also, but they're going to differ just like our English translations do. Yeah, and some of Jesus' statements were made in Aramaic, which is an excellent point. You know, we have some second century, at least one, if not more, authors who tell us that Matthew wrote his gospel originally in Aramaic. And since it was the gospel of the Jews, that would make sense. But we don't have any of those that original thing in Aramaic. So any copy, anything, if that's right, anything we have of Matthew is a translation of the original to begin with. What's important, and it's that Latin, I just think I like words. I think it's just kind of cool. The ipsissima vox, the very voice, that's what they're giving us. Not the ipsissima verba, the very words all the time. But we are being given the voice. This is what he said, though not every single word is his exact wording. But it's what he meant. It's what he said. And again, that was very typical in ancient writings. And there weren't even quotation marks in your King James Bible. So it's a very new idea, and our technology has kind of lent itself to this. You know, with technology now, we can get exact quotes, and we expect that. Before technology, it's just not how people thought. Anything else? Let's turn our attention to another type of supposed contradiction between the Gospels, and that being differences in details. And let's start with a famous story. Jesus comes across the Sea of Galilee to the area of the Gergesenes, the Gadarenes, it's all the same area. This is recorded for us in Mark 5, Luke 8, and Matthew 8. So the three synoptic Gospels, they all deal with this story. Jesus comes off the boat, steps to the shore, Mark chapter 5, verse 2, and when he had come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man. And we learned that that man was possessed of so many demons. Jesus said, "What is your name?" And what did the demon respond? Legion, for we are many. And there were enough demons in this man to inhabit a herd of about 2,000 swine. It was a remarkable thing. You wonder, how did an individual get there? Luke chapter 8, verse 27, telling the same story. When he stepped out on the land, there met him a certain man. So that adds up, same deal. But when we go to Matthew's account, Matthew 8, 28, when he had come to the other side, to the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two demon-possessed men. I'm sure some of us have noticed these things, and you thought, what's going on? We have a similar situation when the women come to the tomb on Sunday morning. In Matthew and in Mark, we are told about one angel who met them and spoke to them. If we go to Luke's account, we're told of two angels. So these are definite differences in details. What's going on? To someone coming at these ancient Eastern books with modern Western standards, we might look at that and go, sure looks like somebody's not giving us an accurate testimony, and I don't have any way of knowing which one it is. You can't tell me these things are inspired and infallible when they've got stuff like that in them. Furthermore, and let's turn to this one, Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20. Well-known event in the life of Jesus, but we'll just refresh our memories and notice the details. We're going to look at two accounts. We're starting with Matthew's, though. Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to begin in verse 20, and we're going to take two verses. Matthew 20, starting in verse 20. Give everybody a chance to get there. Matthew 20, 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons. Now, who are Zebedee's sons? James and John, right. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him. So she comes to Jesus with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left, on the left, in your kingdom." Now, of course, they were expecting an earthly kingdom. And this earthly kingdom means there's going to be a cabinet, there's going to be positions of power and authority and advising the king. So she is asking that her two sons get each of those two high places. And we'll talk about Jesus' answer here in a moment. So who asked Jesus If James and John could sit on Jesus' right hand and his left when he comes into his kingdom, who asked that question? Right. Let's go to Mark. Mark chapter 10. It's a parallel account. Mark chapter 10, and we're going to begin in verse 35. Mark chapter 10, beginning in verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Grant us that we may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory." So who asked the question? Okay, this says James and John. Now you can understand why someone might look at that. Now granted, I don't think most people who read through the Gospels the first time, second time, third time, probably tend to even notice those things. But some will. And you can understand why someone might look at that, and maybe some of you right now are looking at that and go, "I don't know what to do with that." Well, let's back up and let's talk for just a moment about those demon-possessed men and the angels at the tomb. And then we'll come back to this scenario. In those two accounts said one number, one account said the other. What's going on? Well, let me ask you about the demon-possessed men situation. All right. What would be a possible, just common sense explanation? Two accounts say Jesus encountered this man who was possessed of these demons, and then Matthew says there were two of them. What would be a possible common sense explanation of that?
One was helping the
other coming to Jesus or whatever. All right. You want to elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, I don't know about coming to Jesus, but of the two, you got any other thoughts there, Alan? I mean, you're walking down the right path. Okay, that's possible, although it did say in Matthew that both of them were demon-possessed. So I don't think that's probably not going to work exactly. Yeah?
Maybe only one was cured or healed.
Okay.
And so you'd only mention the one who was healed because the other one's not really relevant anymore.
Okay, that's an interesting thought. Anything else? All right.
Maybe.
Yes, maybe. So we're just thinking out loud right now. But yes, it would be possible that one is serving as the spokesperson. One is playing a more prominent role in this situation. And so that's the one who gets focused on. I remember sitting in an Old Testament class in college. And the teacher was taking kids through the book of Genesis. And I was talking with somebody about this after the first session, about some of these college classes and things you can encounter. And I will never forget, he was looking at Genesis 6 and 7. And in Genesis 6, God tells Noah to get two of every animal. But then when you get to chapter 7, and I mean, it's on the same page in your Bible. Same book, same page. Just a few verses later, God's telling him to get seven of every clean animal. And so he goes, "Look, an obvious, this. Look at this contradiction." And I just raised my hand. And I said, "Well, seven would include two, wouldn't it?" And he goes, "This is exactly what he did." "Well, yeah, you could say that." And that was interesting. I thought that was an interesting response. Here he is with all these letters after his name, making this such powerful, definite point. And I just came back with that. And he had to admit, well, yeah, that would be a possible explanation. Not one that he was going to share with the class. It wasn't as juicy. But I think we could have something like that, but we can go beyond that. There's a gentleman by the name of Michael Lacona. He is an historian who studies history, and he looked into Plutarch's life. Some of you may know who Plutarch is. Plutarch was a first and early second century Roman historian. He lived in the Greek part of the Roman Empire, but he wrote over 60 biographies. He called them lives. You can still buy today Plutarch's lives because we've got 50 of them. They have survived. Now, Lacona did something interesting. He thought, okay, here's this Greco-Roman writer writing histories of individuals, biographies of individuals, just like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are, and at the same time. And he wrote so many of them that he wrote a lot about several. Lacona took nine of them, and he chose these nine because these nine talked about people who knew each other and whose lives overlapped. So what he was able to do is this. All right, Plutarch writes this biography of this individual whose life overlapped with this individual. Plutarch wrote a biography about each one, and so he ends up talking about some of the same events in each one. Same author, talking about the same events, and Lacona was interested in seeing how does Plutarch, operating according to first century Roman, Greco-Roman biographical convention, how does he handle these? And what he observed were several compositional devices, among them what he called spotlighting. Keep this in mind. Plutarch writes these. You've read them. You're keeping up with Plutarch's writings. You've read one of these, and then you get one of the other biographies, and Plutarch's mentioning a same event, but he describes the event in this way differently. Over here, in this biography, he mentions maybe two or three people, and over here, he doesn't. Maybe he mentions one individual. Here's how Lacona describes it. This is what Plutarch was doing, and it's what the gospel writers are doing. When an author focuses attention on a person so that the person's involvement in a scene is clearly described, whereas mention of others who were likewise involved is neglected, the author has shined the literary spotlight on that person. Think of a theatrical performance. During an act in which several are simultaneously on the stage, the lights go out, and the spotlight shines on a particular actor. Now, others are present, but they are unseen. In literary spotlighting, the author only mentions one of the people present, though he knows of the others. Now, Plutarch did this, and I think that's what the gospel writers are doing, and I will tell you, I do it in my own life. I didn't bring my phone up here. I thought about doing it. It'd give you all a good laugh. It's not a smartphone. And I'm able to text on it, but I do not text on it with the same ease that some of you text on your phones. So because of that, I try to condense, get to the point, and make my text as efficient as possible most of the time. Sometimes that's not always easy. So about 6 months or so ago, I'm over at Murray Road on a Sunday morning. Services end. My mom, who's 90 years old, she says, "I'd like to take you all out for dinner." Right. My mom lives at John Knox Village. I won't bore you with all the details. I didn't know there were restaurants over there, but there are. She wants to take her children out to one of these restaurants. Well, I agree, as do my sister Brenda and her husband Gordon and my brother Tim. That was all that was maybe present or able to do it. So my mom has invited us all to go out to eat with her. She's going to pay. All right, well, this was a change of plans. So I text Amber. And I say, now I think there may have been time constraint too, and I've got this phone. I say, going out to lunch with my mom. Now, have I lied? Well, I don't mention Gordon. I don't mention Brenda. I don't mention Tim. My mom was the star of the show. My mom was the reason we were going. My mom's paying. Yeah, I'm going out to eat with them, but really all of us are going out to eat with her. So I spotlighted her. That told what needed to be told. And in the same way, apparently one of those two demon-possessed men figured more prominently. Maybe he was the one doing the speaking. He was the main figure. Same way with the angels at the tomb. Yes, there were two there, but one was more predominant. Maybe he was the only one doing the speaking. You say, well, okay, I can see that. But this thing with James and John and his mom, that's a little different. Because one of them said, "Mom asked," and the other one said, "James and John asked." All right. Well, first of all, Matthew does tell us that all three came to Jesus. Even though Zebedee's wife is the one asking the question, Matthew does say James and John were with her. Okay. Mark just mentions James and John. So it sounds like Mark's probably doing a little bit of spotlighting. But let's go back to Matthew, and let's notice how the text reads very carefully. Matthew chapter 20, and we're going to start in verse 20 again, and we're going to keep reading. Matthew 20:20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on the left in your kingdom." But Jesus answered and said, now notice his answer. Who asked the question? But Jesus answered and said, "You," and it's plural, "y'all do not know what y'all ask. Are y'all able," this is the Greek, I'm giving you the up-to-date translation here, "are y'all able to drink the cup that I'm able to drink and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And who answers? They said to him, "We are able." Did Zebedee's wife ask the question? Yes. Did James and John ask the question? Yeah. Because when the question is asked, who does he answer? He doesn't answer her. He answers them. What's going on? Well, I don't know if they've put mom up to it or mom had the idea and they liked the idea. But the driving force here ultimately that both writers end up highlighting is James and John wanted this. Mom was involved. And when the apostles learned about it in verse 24, when the apostles learned about this, who were they upset with? James and John. So this is an example of where we've got differences, but differences do not equal discrepancies. And if we look at the text carefully, we can see how they come together. It does require some thinking. You know, in my opinion, the Lord has made it easy enough that anybody who wants to know the truth will find it, but he's made it hard enough that if you don't, you won't. It seems to have been done purposely. That's why he spoke in parables. Okay, if you don't really want it, you won't see it. He asked at the end of John, was it 8? Yes. John 6. "Why do you not understand my speech?" Because you are not able to listen to my word. You are of your father, and the desires of your father you want to do. If I don't want to know the truth, I will miss it. Are there any comments or questions on this? I know we're getting pretty down into details.
John, as we look at the different writers of the gospel and perhaps infer the purpose for why they were writing, who they were writing to, would that help explain the emphasis on some things and not on others? So that
sometimes
it just appears to me that if God had wanted one account only, that's all we would have.
Right.
And if he wanted us to believe that different people experienced this and their story came from their experience and that story served a specific purpose, This all the more shows us that this is true.
Yes.
Rather than four people having a uniform made up story that everything was exactly the same.
I appreciate that. Steve mentioned that last week after the class. You know, if you had multiple accounts and they all read identically, what would we conclude? There's been collusion. But this is the way witness testimony works. There will be differences. And any investigator, and I'm thinking, if some of you may have heard the name J. Warner Wallace, he was a cold case detective, was an atheist, came to a belief in Scripture and in the Gospels. We'll probably talk a little bit about him next week. This is one of the things he highlights, that this is exactly, I mean, cold cases are where, you know, it's a murder case, there's no statute of limitations, so they just sit there. They just sit there. And it was his job to come back to those and try to drum up witnesses and so forth and discuss, talk with them and try to piece it together. And he was very good at it. He was able to find out. And he said, you know, the Gospels are very much like this. This is a cold case. And I'm trying to figure out, is this real eyewitness testimony, is it trustworthy? And he goes, as he started reading these things, I don't want to give away what we're talking about next week, but he said, particularly with the book of Mark, he said it took him about a month. He bought his, he, All right, I will go ahead and tell just a little bit of the story. He was an officer, of course, and he had this buddy at work who kept inviting him to church. He didn't want to go. But he finally felt like he couldn't turn him down, so he and his family go to church one Sunday. And he had no interest in following Jesus as the Son of God. Zilcho. But in the course of the sermon, the pastor starts talking about how Jesus was this really smart guy, quote unquote, who gave a lot of wisdom about relationships and life and work. And he thought to himself, well, you know, I'm not interested in Jesus as the Son of God, but, you know, a good teacher I'm interested in. So a week later, he buys his first Bible. And he starts reading through the Gospels. And he was trained in what's called forensic statement analysis, you know, talking with witnesses and determining whether they were telling the truth or not. And he said, after reading the book, Gospel of Mark, 1 month, I was convinced this is real eyewitness testimony. It read like real eyewitness testimony. And he talks about how when you come to a crime scene and you've got witnesses, what you do not want is for them to already be over here talking with each other. Because without even trying, they start formulating this same story. What you want is you want to get those witnesses, keep them away from each other, and then talk with them separately. And he goes, they will sound just exactly like the Gospels. One piece will end up by one witness, will end up filling the hole by another witness, and it will eventually just come into a cohesive whole. But you do kind of have to work to bring it together. But it's not forced, it's not labored, it's just the way human testimony works, even honest eyewitness testimony. So what we have here is very true to life. There's no collusion here. No one can claim that. Anyway, anything else? Okay.
But when I look at the Gospels, John, I see chronological discrepancy.
I read through the Gospels, and I notice that sometimes the same event will be in a different place. It's not in the same order. Ever notice that? I'm sure some of us have probably noticed that. And to some extent, you can already see where I'm headed on this. But for one thing, did Jesus ever tell the same parable twice? What do you think? I certainly think it's a possibility. Now, I know you're never going to do this, but let's say you decided to make your life miserable and you were going to write a one-year biography of me. All right, so John Morris came to Carrollton Sunday morning. He stepped up to the pulpit and he spoke saying, all right, and I give this lesson and you condense it, you give a paraphrase of it, boom. Well, then 6 months later, John Morris arrived at Meadville and he stepped to the pulpit and he spoke saying, and it's the same sermon. And it ends up being very, very similar, but of course it's in a completely different place in my life and in my work. It's very likely possible that Jesus did that. So that may account for some of that we see. He told the same parable at a different place, at a different time. But again, in Greco-Roman biography, the life of the main character was not always covered in chronological sequence, and particularly with philosophers or teachers or sages, they would group things categorically. And it's interesting, you go to Matthew 13, and here are these seven parables on the kingdom, all boom, 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 bang, bang. Did Jesus really tell seven all in a row? Well, he might have. Or might Matthew just be bringing them all together to give us a sampling of his teaching, as they did in first century writings? Certainly a possibility. But the Gospels never promise that they're giving us a sequential order of Jesus' ministry, and that was not the expectation. And therefore, we have no reason in 21st century America to require this of them. Ancient Eastern writings should not be judged by modern Western standards. But Luke did say he was going to write an orderly account. But orderly, that Greek word, doesn't just mean sequential. Logical order. My notes are ordered, sort of, but they're not in sequential order. They're in hopefully a logical order. So Luke's statement did not require that. Now, all that said, you might be thinking, well, what? Do we not know the order of Jesus' ministry at all? Well, of course, we have some bookends, don't we? I mean, there is his baptism, there's his death, burial, and resurrection. So we do have some signposts there, here and there. But there is something kind of interesting. All right, so you can see the abbreviations for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. The synoptics, the ones who talk about a lot of the same material. Matthew and Mark will sometimes agree in order, but they will disagree with Luke. Mark and Luke will sometimes agree in order, but they will disagree with Matthew. But when Matthew and Luke agree, they always agree with Mark. So what's the common denominator? It may be that Mark is the one giving us the exact order of Jesus' ministry. That's not conclusive evidence by any stretch. It's circumstantial. But it may be that when you're reading Mark, and I have a Harmony of the Gospels at home. Some of you have probably got one. And it is interesting that in their work, Mark just goes in order, and everything else is shifted around Mark. So it's an interesting thing, and you know, just something maybe keep in the back of your mind as you're reading. Something else. Let's look at an example. Who can tell me the order of Jesus' temptations? What was the first temptation? All right, right. Yeah, stones to bread. And then after that? Yeah, depends on which gospel you're reading. In Matthew, the next one is he goes up to the pinnacle of the temple. And the third one is he'll go up to the high mountain, shows him all the kingdom of the world, bow down to me. And as you read through Matthew, here's how it goes. After the first temptation, Matthew says, then, goes to the second temptation. And then he says, again, the third temptation. Then, again, those are order words. Matthew's claiming this is how it went. Well, you go over to Luke, the first one's the same, but the second and third are in a different order. And if you're reading from the New King James like I am, it'll say, first temptation, then second temptation, then third temptation. That looks like a contradiction. Would someone please read Luke chapter 4, verse 5 from say the King James or the New American Standard or the ESV? Luke chapter 4, verse 5, and really I'm just looking for the first word. If you're reading from the King James or the New American Standard or the ESV, Bill?
And the devil took him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time.
All right, so where my translation says, then the devil took him up, which one was that?
This is the ESV.
All right, the ESV renders it, and. You'll notice the same is true again in the New American Standard, a very good translation, and even the King James. Go to chapter 4, verse 9, just leading up to the third temptation, and in those translations, what's the word?
And.
It's and again. Now, and is not an ordered word. What does and indicate? Also, as well. The Greek word is kai. It's one of the very first words you learn when you start studying Greek. And the early definition I was given on my flashcard. And, even, also. I do not know why the New King James translators did what they did. But Luke is not claiming this is the order the translation, the temptations went in. He's telling us there was one, and there was another, and there was another. These were the three, but there's no claim to order. Again, I know we're down in the weeds, but these are the sorts of things that people will be swayed by. There are whole books devoted to this sort of thing. Let's look at one more example. Mark chapter 15, verse 25. Mark chapter 15, verse 25. Short verse, to the point, as we've discussed, the Gospels are. And it says this of Jesus' crucifixion. Now, it was the third hour, and they crucified him. So Jesus was crucified. When? Third hour. Now, if you trace Jesus from the time he is taken out of the garden by the guards and Judas till the time he goes to the cross, he goes through six different hearings, three Roman, three Jewish. The final hearing is another one in front of Pilate, and Pilate then, of course, washes his hands of the matter, not really, and condemns him to be crucified. This is recorded for us in John 19. Let's go over there, John 19, 14. And John's going to give us a time during which this sixth and final hearing was taking place. John 19, 14. Someone want to read it for us? Well, at face value, that looks like a contradiction, doesn't it? You can't have the hearing after the crucifixion. What do you think? Anybody have any thoughts? Paul's got one, way over in the corner. I'm trying to make you walk as far as you can, Bill. Oh, someone else. Oh, the mic's coming your way.
If memory served me correctly, the third hour, soldiers had watches, just like we did in the Navy. You know, you got first watch, second watch, third watch. Mm-hmm. I think I recall the third hour being the third watch, which would place it at around 9 o'clock in the morning. That's just
okay.
Help me out if I'm not correct on that. But
well, I have to admit I can't speak to that phrasing being used for their watches. They, you know, among the Jews, they called the nighttime hours watches, the daytime hours. I don't know about that particular thing, Paul. How many timekeeping systems were at work in the Roman Empire in the first century? At least how many? So you had the Jewish system, and then there would have been the Roman system. And the Roman system operated exactly like ours. Ours is the Roman system. So according to the Jewish system, the third hour was what? Approximately 9 a.m. The sun comes up around 6. Third hour would be around 9 a.m. Now, in the Roman system, because it's like ours, you had 2 6th hours every day. One at 6 p.m. and one at 6 a.m. So if John, who says that this hearing before Pilate was happening in the sixth hour, if he's using the Roman system, then this works just fine. Jesus' crucifixion begins at 9 a.m. This hearing before Pilate was happening at 6 a.m., which does add up because it says very early in the morning the Jewish council got together to finalize things and get it to Pilate. They were trying to make this thing happen as soon as they possibly could. You say, well, and number one, if you go through John's gospel, he mentions time 3 times. The other 2 occasions are in chapter 1, verse 39, and in chapter 4, verse 6. In all 3 of those occasions, Roman time fits perfectly. So it lines up. Now, the question is, as we close, why might John have used Roman time as opposed to Jewish time? Yeah, it's thought that John's gospel was written later. John may be writing after Jerusalem has been destroyed, the temple has been destroyed. He may not even be living in the promised land anymore. So in his time, when he's writing this gospel, he's using the Roman time, the time that's going to be operative for his audience, as opposed to where the others may have been writing earlier on. So I know we were really down in the weeds, to borrow a phrase from Wade tonight, but I thought maybe some of this could be helpful. I'll try not to beat you over the head so much with details next week.